Good morning, everybody. It is November the 3rd, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom. I am your host, Frank. Cannot wait to get into the poetry today. We have an autumn poem, even though it is winter for sure here in the Adirondacks. We don't quite have snow on the ground yet, but we had snow in the air yesterday. A bit of a bite to that snow in the air, too. So my dog, my Newfie, was sticking her head out the door of the car, out the window of the car as we drove along, and she had to keep yanking it back in because at 25 miles an hour, that snow on her snout must have been like some strong pellets for her. Not her favorite thing. But she kept trying it because the smells are her favorite thing. Also yesterday, we had some interesting political results. I called the election in Virginia correctly. I did not foresee the election in New Jersey being as tight as it is. Still not able to be called this morning. Wow. Did not expect to wake up to that. All right, so let's get into our poetry here. Here's the thing about poems. I read one to my wife once, and she fell asleep. One time I wrote a poem, right, to my girlfriend way before this, and the next time I came over to apartment, I saw the poem crumpled up in the corner lying next to the litter box, and the cat had peed on it, right? This is what you get when you start down this poetry path. You tell someone you're a poet, and 70%, I think, 75% of the reactions you get somehow, one way or the other, involve laughter, right? You get that, wow, or you get that, oh, really? You get those reactions, right? Or the worst laughter reaction, right, is the one where you don't get the laughter, but you know that the laugh is coming later, right? And they're talking to their BFF, and they're like, yeah, I swiped right, but he is a poet. Oh, my God, I know, right? Do those even exist anymore? But, you know, you just can't quit on it, can you? You can't quit on poetry. Poetry is the most addictive literature out there. It's easy to quit on novels, right? Have you even read Nausgaard? I mean, yeah, sorry, Carl Ove, but you named your book My Struggle. You're kind of asking for it. So it's easy to quit novels. I mean, they're long, they're heavy to carry around, they don't fit on a single screen in your laptop, they go against the Aristotelian principle of unity, they don't nicely size up for your phone or for your reader. There's so much scrolling involved, and let's face it, for goodness sakes, 50 Shades of Grey was the best-selling novel of the last decade. Who wants to be associated with that, huh? Come on. So, you know, how are you going to do that? You're going to run for office at some point and somebody's going to say, oh, they're a novel reader. You don't want that on your record. I mean, I read novels too, right? But poetry is the stuff, right? Poetry is an addiction. Poetry, it gets in there and you can't shake it. It's designed to haunt your mind. That's what it does. It stimulates more than just the higher order conceptual thinking. It stimulates that too, of course. Unless you're reading HD. Oh, sorry. But, you know, the poetry gets the blood pumping on many other levels too, right? The sound, the growling beast, the movement. Poetry, it's the most physical, it's the most spiritual, most addictive, as I say, of literature. It's not just about the meaning, but it's about the sound and texture of the words themselves, the words as object. It gives it a physicality, an intimacy, a contact that makes all other literature feel lonely. There's nothing to touch in that other stuff. So let's get to the touching. Oh, that sounds terrible. Anyway, we're going to look at Plow. Plow is a fantastic institute, organization, cross-media platform, and they've been publishing some excellent poems lately. The first one that we're going to look at here is an old cassette letter by Andrew Frizzardi. Now, remember the rules here for poetry appreciation at the ADK homeroom. First, we toss out the poets. This is not the theory where you have to know N. Scott Momaday's elementary school lunch menu on the first day of seventh grade in order to understand an angle of geese. This is not the art theory that says, you know, once you know Donald Judd's history, then you can understand why little red rectangle play blocks are freighted with such profound implications for the fate of American teenage dreams. That's not our theory. Toss out the poets. And I'm not going to read you the whole poem. Not sure the poet would want that. It's like a band covering someone else's song without permission. But I am sure that that's not the best use of our time. I will call out specific pieces and portions, of course. So, an old cassette letter. The first thing that leaps off the page and smacks you physically, tangibly, is this is a sonnet. In fact, it is almost Spenserian sonnet. It is A-B-A-B-B-C-B-C for your octet, your first eight lines, and then the turn, and it breaks with Spenser at that point, and it's D-E-E-D-F-F. You know, turning the page onto a sonnet, that's like open the door to your summer cabin, right? Same shape, same form, welcome you in once again. Maybe you have a new wind assailing the wide blossom in the window box. Maybe you have some new oven birds or some new swans out there. But it's the same summer cabin. Lovely to live in a sonnet for a while. And of course, it's perfectly appropriate form for this poem because the poem takes as its central object an old, familiar, and in some ways comforting technology, an old friend, the cassette tape. Remember that? I still say to my students sometimes, I still do that old cassette joke. First of all, I ask them if they know what a cassette tape is, tape player, how they worked. And I'm getting about 50% success these days with people understanding what they are. And then, you know, you do that old joke, right? You take the pieces of masking tape or scotch tape or duct tape or electrical tape, whatever you have, and you put one in each hand. And you go up to the person just like you did in 1984 in eighth grade before shop class while you're waiting to be dismissed. Or maybe you're in shop class waiting to be dismissed. And you say, you got these two tapes, pieces of tape on your hand. You say, you want to hear my tapes? And they say, yeah. And you put your hands over their ears. Oh, it's somewhat hilarious, but it's more about the old familiar technology. So, you've got the sonnet here, old familiar form, jumping off the page, and then you notice that it's all about the complementary nature of technology and human life, of the voice and the ear, of the poet and his earlier self, of the friend and the speaker, of the male and the female. Because if you look at the first four lines, you've got a female rhyme with afforded and recorded, and you've got young and strung. And that's just the female complimenting the male, which is perfectly in line with the theme of the poem here. It says, referring to both the speaker and the addressee, it says, we were both so strung on complimentary hurt, my ulcered tongue, your guttural self-doubt. And that's the focus, this complimentary nature of the speaker and the addressee. It says, at odds we clung. And that's just a strong internal rhyme coming up and smacking you there in line three at the end of a sentence, begging to be tied. That clung is begging to be tied to young and strong, and it puts you in the mind of the internal. So right away, you have all these different complementary natures that you're pondering just in the first four lines of the poem. You're thinking about, as I said, the complement of the male and the female, the complement of the young and the old, the complement of the internal and the external, the complementing natures, the completing each other natures of the speaker and the addressee. Then you get into the fifth and sixth lines, and you've got this wonderful complement, as I just read, between tongue, the ulcered tongue, and the guttural self-doubt, the gut, the throat here. And notice the ionic right there, the pyrrhic, followed by a spondee, your guttural self-doubt. Complementary to the regular iams elsewhere in the poem. You have the form supporting the theme itself, a complement. I love it. I love this recursion of theme. Let's talk a little bit about the words themselves, these tangible delights. Nothing exotic here. This is a day-to-day diction. This is the vocabulary of a let the guard down, friendly conversation, recorded at the end of the day, put it in the puffy envelope, and mail it off across the world, wherever it is going, from west to east, perhaps. So this diction, it suits the subject here. Nothing fancy. There's no maculate giraffe. This isn't Sweeney among the nightingales. There's no mind reading in the crenellate shade of Richard Wilbur. Nothing thrilling like maculate or crenellate, just the words of technology here, replay and ulcer, right? If you don't know the history of ulcer in the 1980s, that is a fantastic story of some scientific heroes, some great technology, some great science, scientific experiments there. So if you're talking about the heyday of cassette tapes, the 1980s, ulcer is not a bad place. Not a bad word at all to include. You have the starts and the stutters of a tape player that isn't quite as faithful to real sound as it could be, or maybe it is faithful and the person speaking is more like technology than he might realize. You have forward and backward on the tape. You have side one and side two. You have these two complementary parts. It's just perfect, right? It's just perfect to pick a cassette tape, a cassette letter between two people complementing each other, completing each other, just like the two sides of a tape can be played forward, can be played backward, can be flipped over. It is just a perfect object to be the symbol for what we're talking about in this poem, or what the speaker is talking about in this poem. Another complement that might not be quite so obvious is east and west in this poem. But if you know about tape cassette players, you know that perhaps, and or I should say tape cassette letters, you know that perhaps the most famous single use of this practice was between Pakistanis in England and their relatives back in Pakistan, right? If you go to tapeletters.com, for example, that is the subject of the website there. And the language, by the way, is not mostly Urdu in this practice. It was mostly Potwari, which is northern Pakistan. So if you want to be specific about it, and you should, it's not Urdu. But the subtitle of tapeletters.com is Migration on Tape, right? And you've got migration going on in this poem from the first eight lines through the turn into the concluding sestet. We are put in mind again of yet another complementary relationship, the migrant and the resident, the wanderer and the settler, the foreign and the domestic. So then you move on into your final six lines, and what was complementary in the first stanza by proximity, by propinquity, as Millay might say, with her elevated diction that we're not getting in this poem. What was complementary in the first stanza by proximity is flung apart here in the second stanza, thought and heart. It is this his own voice, perhaps, that he is flinging away. And you can see it foreshadowed in the last line of the octet. You see, you have, before long we'll be flung, beyond the range our voices have today. Notice the internal rhyme here is internal near rhyme, actually. Before we had that strong, clung, young, strong internal rhyme. Now the internal rhyme has become strained. It is not as strong. It is stretched beyond almost what it can endure, certainly beyond what it can endure with the technology of cassette tapes. But if only they had 2021's range of voice, clearly talking about the voice of the poet too here, not just the voice of poetry in general, not just the voice of the speaker and the addressee. And what a cheerful and sanguine idea it is, positing such a helpful role for technology, as if technology were the third buddy in this poem that sort of unites the two friends here. But as we say, we go through the turn, and then that we get to the pathos of the poem here, right? We find out the addressee has committed suicide. There is no technology available that can bridge that gap. Nothing to communicate with the dead. So we go right from this great, cheerful, optimistic view of technology to whoops, we have once again gone past the ability of a cassette letter to hold us together. Even with this advancement of technology, now we've got a duality here that is deeper than that. We can't cover it after all. But maybe there is something that can bridge, or at least attempt to establish some sort of dialogue across that life-death gap, at least some sort of technology that it can equip us to face it. And what is that? Well, it's as obvious as the poem itself. It's the sonnet, right? It's the form here as the sonnet. It's an old technology, it's an enduring one, and it's famous for conquering death, right? Shakespeare in the famous one, Summer's Day, number 18, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. So that's what we're seeing here. Maybe the cassette letter can't do it, maybe 2021's new technology can't do it, but the poet retreats to the timeless sonnet, the enduring, the immortal, dare I say, sonnet. And you get the merging of tech and the body as you go on here. You see that the poet says, the addressee's words replay inside my heart again. This is a poem that embraces technology, right? You've got words replaying that very technical tape cassette letter word replaying inside my heart. It's a cyborg poem. This is transhumanism. I love it. Transhumanism is coming to poetry. Oh my gosh, call Eclipse Face. Let them know. So, you know, the speaker wouldn't be able to hear these words, right? We see in the last two lines, the speaker wouldn't be able to hear these words if what became of distance were not near. So you've got, again, the complementary idea of distance and nearness, proximity, the dual nature there. And let's think, what has become of distance? It's kind of a difficult last line, right? But think about it. What has become of distance? On the one hand, the world has shrunk, cell phones, internet, video, connection to other continents on demand. But on the other hand, that just highlights the distance between life and death, between the living and the dead, which makes that gap seem even larger, right? It's the one river that we cannot lay our cables across. And the speaker needs that new idea of distance to be able to hear his old friends, his old lovers, his younger self's words replaying in his heart. And I have to point out one delicious thing here about the form too, just awesome thing. You've got a contraction and a not a contraction in lines 13 and 14 here in the sonnet, right? In 13, in starts and stutters that I wouldn't hear. But then in line 14, if what became of distance were not near, right? That could have been weren't near. It could have been would not hear. But you've got a contraction in one line and you have a not, you know, you have the word spelled out. The poet eschews the contraction in the second line 14. And that is just an amazing mastery of the language there, showing that you can have a contraction of distance or you can have the full expansion of distance. And we're addressing both themes in this poem. It's just one more duality, one more example of complementary nature. The eight lines, the six lines, the beginning, the end, the contraction, the non-contraction. So, in the end, what does it come down to? Well, you know, are we supposed to read this as two old friends, perhaps separated by a continent, just exchanging cassette letter, just hanging out of an evening and sipping some Ru'afza and then sending off your letter in the puffy envelope with a little bubble wrap inside there with the letter recorded audibly, orally, so that the sounds of the words are jewels for your ears. Maybe. Or is the poet speaking to a part of himself, the ulcered tongue to the straining throat? Is it lovers separated? I think, once again, the answer is as obvious as the form itself. This is Spenserian sonnet, at least for the first eight lines, and then a divergence. And like Spenser's Great Fairy Queen, the allegory here is multiple. The meaning can be taken along multiple lines of argument. All are meant. All are meant. And of course, even beyond allegory to more modern meanings, as suggested by the sestet, although personally, I am not convinced that allegory is as limited as many modern pundits would have it. But that's a topic for another podcast. Now, let's briefly look at another poem in Plow. All right, I just have to say one more thing about the cassette letter. We're seeing more and more and more over the last decade the intrusion of technology into poetry, and I would encourage you to embrace it, right? Even in traditional forms like the sonnet, technology is fertile grounds in which to grow your metaphors, in which to grow your figurative language. I do not think that 200 years from now, people looking back will see technology-based figurative language and scoff at it. Do not think that at all. All right, now let's go on to our next poem here. Jean Krelling from Able Muse. You might know her from Able Muse. She writes, after helping my father rake the leaves. Right, so after helping my father rake the leaves, already you're thinking of some other poems that you might want to compare that to, some poems about fathers and quotidian chores and offices of love. But let's look at this poem here. It's iambic tetrameter. Your heart is pounding, right, with those iambs. You got young, quick lines tripping by quickly, breathing fast, tumbling energy, just like the kid who begins the poem jumping into a pile of leaves. Good choice on meter here, Miss K. It's mostly end-stopped, a few enjambments to begin the poem, again highlighting the singing, the rhyme, and the fun of youth. And notice then that the first real enjambment occurs right before the poem gets darker. Here it is. I breathed more deeply for a few enchanted seconds. More leaves flew as Dad watched. A few enchanted seconds. And then Dad represents the bite of the seasons, the moving beyond these enchanted seconds, the rush from one line into the next, from the young into the old, from one season into another, represented or supported by the enjambment there. And Dad knows what seasons take. So we're moving, just like our enjambment, from one line to the next, from the beginning of the poem to the next. I love it. Great, great use there of the form to inform, the meaning of the poem. So you've got Dad seeing what seasons take, and we see that technology is starting to interfere with the cocoon of nature that we had at the start, right? The child foreshadowing this transformation that's going on in the poem. The child is in the pile of leaves like a cocoon, and he's going to come out, or she is going to come out at the end. Perhaps a butterfly, we will see. But you do see that the technology is coming in here because it suddenly describes the leaves here. I will read, it says, leaves bright as fire broadcast their dark reminder. Beauty was a spark. Again, you see the enjambment there signifying difference from the beginning of the poem. And you see that technology here with broadcast, this is a very technological word, right? I did not look up to see OED's first recorded usage of this in the modern sense, but of course it has an old meaning of spreading things widely across a large area, but it has become, just as in the poem, the cocoon takes the child from youth to a more full understanding of the world and of her father. The word broadcast has become completely, well, maybe not completely, but almost completely associated with technology. Whether you're talking about the broadcasts of the 1920s and the first radio broadcast, or whether you're talking about casters on the internet right now, what doing esports and things like that, this new horizon that has opened up for kids these days, a new career path. So yeah, and we had our second strong jamming running there from the young to the old, great reinforcement. And then I wanted to point out that this poem also, of course, as I've mentioned when we first started talking about it just vividly places in your head Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays. Everybody knows this poem, right? Love's austere and lonely offices, the father working, even though he knows the costs of working. The seasons are praised for their beauty, even though by the end of the poem they are recognized for their mercilessness. Anne Crailing here, she ends her poem with a vision of a visage, her father's profile still held strong against the wind. Even though he has passed away now, she faces her own autumn seasons with her father's will. That is the last word of the poem. And at first, it might strike you as a little bit off, but it's actually quite a pun, isn't it? Her father's will. And he seems to have willed for her quite the riches if he left to her whatever was necessary to compose this poem. And then if you finish up by comparing it to Those Winter Sundays, which would be, any science fiction movie these days, you have to compare it to Star Wars. And if you're writing a sonnet, it's going to be inescapable, especially if you're writing a sonnet, as we were discussing in the first half of this program, especially if you're writing a sonnet that talks about themes of mortality and immortality. It's inevitable that Shakespeare and his enduring sonnets will be drawn into the discussion. It's the same here. If you're going to write a poem about doing chores, or your father doing chores like raking the leaves or banking the fire and building the fire up again on a winter Sunday, you're going to be compared to the great poem by Robert Hayden there, Those Winter Sundays. And so, as we are obliged to do when we compare the two poems, we see that in this poem, she's carrying on. The speaker here is carrying on this great tradition of viewing the masculine, the commitment to work, the willingness to be the hero, the willingness to say to self-sacrifice for the sake of the family. She is willing to see that in a positive light. The speaker is maybe not quite worshiping that in the sense of religious worship, but worshiping that in the sense of hero worship. And that is a rare thing these days. The masculine is constantly under attack in our society, right? In my school where I teach, 18% of the valedictorians over the last dozen years, I tallied this up just last spring, 18% have been male. Our schools are not friendly to boys. Colleges, undergrad degrees right now are almost 60% female. It's almost a 3-to-2 ratio, female to male, in higher education right now. As long as you include medical fields, STEM degrees, even STEM degrees, go more to females than males, as long as you include medical fields, which of course you should. It's really chicanery, trickery, not to include medical fields and STEM fields. And so we see the masculine constantly under attack, and this poem is, just as it suggests, a breath of fresh air. And even though it's an autumn poem, It is seeing things crisply, to seeing things clearly, and it is taking away the positive from what is normally a negative. Normally, the season of decay, Krilling is finding here some positives, and certainly masculinity in eclipse, but perhaps even as it is waning or even in eclipse, we can take some positives from the fact that poems like this are beginning to appear. We will see. We will see where the future takes us. Tomorrow, of course, it will take us to another podcast. Perhaps we'll be dissecting the elections. Perhaps we'll know by tomorrow who won in New Jersey. Don't forget to subscribe. Please remember to find me on Twitter at the ADK Homeroom. Leave some comments at Spotify. Leave some comments wherever you are downloading this podcast. I would appreciate that so much. I hope you have a great autumn, or if you're up in the high peaks like I am here, winter day. Take care.